I'm Paul Roberts, and it's an honor to be here, and not just because it was snowing and icy where I left yesterday. This is I can't think of a more compelling, more appropriate topic to be exploring than energy right now. I mean, I think certently as a scientific and engineering sort of technical community, I don't think we've been as focused on energy to the extent that we are today in a generation. But I have to say that it's a frustrating time to be talking about energy too. Because although in this room, for example, and in rooms like this where people like us are gathered to talk about this, there's a fair degree of awareness and anxiety outside rooms like this, it's different. I mean, all it takes is a slight drop in the price of oil, a slight relaxation in the price of gasoline, and you will see, or sense rather, a sort of a collective sigh of relief. I mean, you've already felt it. It's like, well, we got through it. We somehow have managed once again to solve our energy crisis. I mean, you can hear people sort of drawing that conclusion. You know, there was an article in the paper a few months ago. You probably saw this. It was about this huge discovery of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, 15 billion barrels, right? And the headline, which apparently is all most people read, said, "Discovery increases U.S. oil reserves by 50%. Now, if that was all you read, it would be understandable that you would come away from that encounter thinking, we're there, right? What's to worry about? It's only if you got into the article that a few troubling facts would come up. For example, the 15 billion barrel figure, that was the upper end of a whole range of estimates as to how much was under the ground. The lower end was around 2 or 3 billion barrels. And more plausible mid-range is about 9 billion barrels. All right, now that's a lot of oil. It's enough to last the U.S. for what, 15 months? All right, and you realize that the only way that that discovery can increase U.S. reserves by 50% is if those reserves were puny to begin with, right? That's not the story that gets out. That's not the story that's out there. So I'm at this dinner party shortly after that story comes out, and a fellow that comes up, and he does, I have to say, look quite a bit like the fellow from Napoleon Dynamite. And he says to me, "You must feel like an idiot because U.S. just increased its reserve by yada yada." And I said, "Look, I've got 50 cents in my pocket, and I've just found a quarter on the floor. I've increased my reserves by 50%, right? I still can't get a cup of coffee at Starbucks." You know, then he looks at me and he says, "Great, well, we can make fuel from seawater." And in that conversation sort of encapsulates America's take on energy policy. I mean, that's pretty much it. We have a confidence that no matter how bad things get, solutions are sort of automatically being generated out there, right, by a combination of technological innovation and market forces and divine intervention, and they will be sort of presented to us. And the transition will to a new energy economy is sort of happening automatically. Right? And you know, there's sort of history for this. I mean, clearly, in times past, energy economies that have become unstable have evolved. If we go back to the wood economy of England in the 17th century, as wood becomes scarce, they make the transition to coal. All right? 2 centuries later, as coal becomes less viable in the transportation sector, we make the evolution to oil. And there's every expectation that that process will continue. We'll simply keep evolving, and we will find ourselves 20 or 30 years from now in this brand new energy economy that is cleaner and more efficient and less reliant on places like the Middle East. And what's important to note about this vision is that this transition will have occurred without any intervention. All right? It simply will have happened. Now, I call this sort of thinking, this is faith-based energy policy, all right? Because that's precisely what it's based on. It's based on faith, on hope, that the sort of drivers that have governed the evolution of energy economies in the past will continue to be the drivers that govern the evolution of energy economies going forward. And I have to say that personally, and I hope I'm not unique in this, that I'm not confident that that mechanism applies, at least strictly speaking, as it once did. And I think that as professionals, although we may be fairly secure in our certainty that things need to change, we will encounter continually going forward people who do not share that certainty and who will need to be argued against. And when they present the argument that things are taken care of by themselves, that markets will correct automatically, and that we can essentially go back to sleep, we need to remind ourselves of a couple things. First of all, we need to remind ourselves of what the market delivered to us when this crisis began, all right? We also need to keep in mind that the things we were concerned about, our concerns about oil in particular as a long-term sustainable energy, those concerns we had 5 years ago have not fundamentally changed in the time since. Or if they have changed, they've become worse. That's what we need to spend time thinking on. And I'd like to spend a little time today sort of reviewing those factors that we were concerned about 5 years ago and still should be, and then ask what are the implications going forward. And we'll have a little time for some Q&A, and then we'll be off to the races, so to speak. And the first thing I'd like to look at is demand. All right, demand is clearly, it's worth looking at both for two reasons. One, it's going up faster than we anticipated. It's also going up in ways that we didn't quite anticipate. Now, in this country, for example, we've had high oil prices and high gasoline prices for about 5 years, and yet we are not seeing the changes in consumption that traditional economic thinking would have led us to expect, right? We are driving more in this country this year than last year, more last year than the year before. And then people will tell you, well, you know, we're locked into our driving patterns. We can't drive halfway to work. We can't drive the kids halfway to school, much as we might like to. And I'll agree that. But we're not locked into our car buying patterns, are we? Or we shouldn't be. I mean, it's not as if we collectively, as a nation, went down to the dealership with the idea of buying a Prius, couldn't find one, so we all came home with a Hummer. I mean, there's a broad continuum of choices in between those two endpoints, and yet we're still moving more toward the heavier end. Now, the United States has always been somewhat cavalier in the way it approaches energy consumption. But we are seeing similar sort of patterns of behavior elsewhere in the world. In Europe, for example, this is a bastion of sensible energy use. We're seeing larger cars. All right, then we go to Asia. Asia is the huge story in energy. I mean, right now, you know, most of the news stories you read are about what's going to happen when 350, you know, Chinese drivers are driving, which is a pretty terrifying vision. But the real energy story in Asia isn't about consumers. It's about industry. Because Asia, or China in particular, is trying to do something that no economy, no country has ever tried. They're trying to take a pre-industrial, essentially agrarian economy, 19th century, and transform it into a post-industrial, 21st century, hyper-efficient, and they're trying to do this in the scale of a generation. All right, and a transformation of that scale and ambition takes a tremendous volume of inputs, not least energy. I mean, look at their agricultural sector. This is a country that has fed itself on 200 or 300 million tiny farms of a half acre, 2.5 acres. Tremendously inefficient. The only way they've overcome that inefficiency is because they have a surplus of what? Of labor. China recognizes that if its population is going to continue to grow, and as importantly, if those people are going to eat more meat, which they are, turns out they like meat as much as we do, they're going to need a new food system. They have begun consolidating their food system. Some of those smaller farms are now slightly larger. The good news is that their productivity is going up, their yields are going up. The bad news is that in the process of this consolidation, they are unemploying or underemploying a massive amount of people. Over the next 10 to 15 years, by some estimates, there will be between 200 and 300 million underemployed Chinese farmers. Essentially, the population of this country running around looking for work in that country. Now, Beijing knows that this mass of humanity will collapse their economic and social systems unless they can rapidly reemploy those people in a burgeoning industrial sector. And what do industrial sectors need to keep burgeoning? Energy. And this is why China is now the number two user of oil in the world. All right, they passed Japan 2 years ago, and although they are some years from catching up with the number one user, which is us, they will be there. All right, and when they do, it won't be pretty, because China, like the United States, cannot produce enough oil at home. It relies on international markets. And as it wades further out into those international markets, it discovers there are already a number of other pigs at that trough. Europe, Japan, and the United States. And we're already seeing a competition for remaining oil. A competition that is now becoming part of international relations. We're seeing China and Russia and Japan and India. And all the big users are now maneuvering to lock in access to the big reserves. Right? And that competition is going to color international relations to an increasing degree going forward. Now, I was in China not too long ago talking with an industrial official, and I said, so where is China going to get all the oil for this big, you know, burgeoning industrial revolution? And he looked at me and he said, that's not the right question. The question isn't where China is going to get its oil. You know, it's where you're going to get your oil. You know, and it's a fair question. Because while we're relatively certain where demand is going, we're not at all certain about where supply is going to be coming from. All right, right now, spare production capacity in the system, which for those of you who don't know, is the extra oil wells, the extra tanking and piping capacity that's sort of on the shelf that we can bring online in an emergency. That spare production capacity is as tight as it's ever been. Okay, historically, we've had between 4 and 10 million barrels a day of extra production capacity that we could bring online in case of emergency, most of it in the Middle East. And that's sort of what's softened a lot of the blows in the past, a lot of the price spikes in the past. Today, we've got around 2 to 2.5 million barrels a day. And that's an optimist estimate, which means that if we should have, say, Venezuela go offline, as it did a few years ago, there's no way to fill that shortfall. So that this morning I looked at oil prices and they were at just under $60 a barrel. It's very likely that if a country like Venezuela went offline and with no spare production capacity, we could have prices at $160 a barrel. There's nothing really to stop that from happening. That's where we are. Now, the optimist will tell you, and the adherents of faith-based energy policy will tell you, well, this is not because we're running out of oil, okay? There's plenty of oil. What there isn't enough of is investment in new oil production. We haven't invested enough. Haven't drilled enough new wells, enough new pipelines. And you say, well, okay, why not? It's not as if you're particularly short of cash these days. And they say, that's right, Paul, we're not. But we are prevented from producing where we want to produce. We are politically obstructed. We either are not allowed to drill where we want to drill, by which they mean offshore here or Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or the countries and regions that have a great deal of oil are politically so unstable that we don't want to go there. And what's great about political obstacles is that they're human-made, and they can be human-unmade. And as soon as these political obstacles have been taken care of, the investment will flow in, and the oil will flow out. When someone says this, ask yourself, when's the last time you looked at a newspaper or watched, you know, the news and didn't see something about political instability in any of the following countries? Venezuela, you know, Nigeria, anywhere in the Middle East, Russia, Iraq. I mean, in Iraq, we are going backwards. We are producing less oil there now than we were before the war. All right, Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest reserve of oil, is also the world's biggest reserve of barely constrained Islamic rage. I mean, this is a powder keg. We need to go off. You know, we talk about spreading democracy in the Middle East. Well, you have to ask yourself, if Saudi Arabia were to hold free and fair elections tomorrow, who do you think they would elect? I mean, think about it. It wouldn't be Condoleezza Rice, all right? You know, it would be someone very much like Osama bin Laden. That is where their political culture is, right? For whatever reasons, that is where they're at, right? And with someone like that in power, they would. How long do you think they would be willing to continue to sell us oil? I mean, you know, and this is pretty much the country that we've locked ourselves to. This is our energy ally. Now, I realize in having mentioned Iraq and oil in the same sentence that I'm steering somewhat close to the question of whether oil may have had something to do with why we're over there. Unfashionable, icky question. However, let's avoid the partisan nature of that question and simply ask it in neutral terms. What does the market think that we're doing in Iraq? Why does the market think we went? The market really doesn't care what our motives were, what we knew about what weapons of mass destruction. The market doesn't care at all about agenda. The market cares only about results. And what has the market seen since we've been there in Iraq? Well, the market has seen that since we've been in Iraq, the world's biggest, most sophisticated military power has not been able to create the political, social, or cultural stability necessary to raise oil production. We can't. I'll tell you what else the market has seen. The market has seen that while we are still in Iraq and Afghanistan, and if while we're there, there's a problem in another oil-exporting country, we're not going to be able to do anything about it. We are tapped out. And this sort of comforting idea that the world, particularly the oil world, has enjoyed over the past couple of decades, that America is the political backstop to the oil world, that we will intervene either economically or politically or, worst case, militarily and make the oil flow if the oil stops flowing, that idea is gone. Okay, it may never have been true. It has been proven to be false now. If there's anything we can learn from the Iraq War in the energy realm, it's that. We simply no longer have that fail-safe option. Right now, I tend to get pretty wound up about energy politics and oil politics in particular. I think it's important to do that on a regular basis. But for the sake of this conversation and for the sake of this conference and the themes of this conference, let's subtract politics from the question and simply ask, if Iraq were to heal itself tomorrow and if all other unstable oil-producing countries, exporting countries, were able to follow suit so that we woke up next week sometime and found a politically stable oil world. Would our problems be over? Of course not. We'd be getting down to bedrock issues, if you will. Because regardless of how stable the world is above, there is a finite supply of oil below. All right? Commodities that are finite, and I think we can safely assume that oil is finite at some point, they tend to peak once they've reached a depletion point of about 50%, give or take. And we've seen peak depletion in provinces like the United States. We're talking about it in Mexico. We've seen it in the North Sea. And, of course, the question is, when does the peak strike worldwide? Now, I'm sure you're aware, if you've looked into this at all, there's a wide range of estimates. You have the pessimists who will tell you that the peak happened, oh, I think one was last Thanksgiving. I love folks who are that specific. Then you'll have, and then we're in the middle of a peak. This is what a peak looks like, okay? Then you'll have the optimists, and this would include the U.S. Department of Energy and oil companies publicly, some oil companies. You will hear that, well, yes, oil is finite, and yes, it eventually will peak, but we're not, you know, we've got so much unconventional and tar sands, and the price will drive technological change, and we're not going to see a peak for 40 years, which is plenty of time for alternatives and better efficiency, by which they mean go back to sleep. Now, if you were running a company or a household or a country, and you were trying to make some investment decisions based on that range of estimates, it'd be pointless. I mean, that's no help at all. So what I've tried to do, and I think what a lot of folks in this line of work try to do, is based on what's going on in the market, what's the best guess? And if you do that, I think what you realize is the pessimists are a lot closer to being on the mark than the optimists are. And I'll share a couple of examples with you. Oil companies are struggling to find as much oil as they're selling. Okay, they are. Now, we shouldn't be surprised by this because discovery rates have been declining as well. You know, for most of the last century, we found more oil on average every year. And then about the 1961 or two, discoveries began to come down. We began finding less oil every year, to the point today where we're burning through about 30 billion barrels of oil every year, and we're finding, depending on whose numbers you use, between 10 and 12 billion barrels a year. So the ratio is 3-1. And keep in mind that during this period of declining discovery rates, what's happened? The technology for finding new oil has increased dramatically, hasn't it? We can see underground, we can make 3- and 4-dimensional images of the oil and gas underground. Beyond that, we can also drill. We don't just drill straight down anymore, we drill horizontally. I mean, we're so much better at finding and extracting oil. And yet, during that period of time, we're finding less oil. So, I mean, between these two sort of areas, when we're sort of asking ourselves, is it any time to relax, the politics of oil and the geology of oil, there's not a lot of room for optimism here. And there simply isn't. Now, then the question becomes, well, if oil is declining in production and becoming harder and harder to find, and if at the same time those countries that still have a great deal of oil are less and less politically stable, what's coming next? What's coming next? And that's really going to be the focus of what you're going to be talking about later on. What kinds of technologies are out there? And here I have to remind you that although there's an enormous array of options out there for us, everything from ethanol to hydrogen, geothermal, wind, solar, nuclear, if we can say that out loud here, and a great many other things that we probably don't even know yet, keep in mind that in every case, these technologies are not quite ready for prime time. They are in some way supported publicly. Now, you can make the argument that the oil industry is also supported publicly. This is true, but the oil company is here, or the oil industry is here. It's present. It has, you know, existential inertia. All right? These other technologies are struggling against that. Also keep, now I think what you'll be discussing, you'll be spending a lot of time discussing, well, how can we break that inertia? How can we knock down these barriers to entrance? And that's great, but keep in mind that even if we were to have a technology ready to go tomorrow, let's say the hydrogen fuel cell was ready to go, it was cost competitive, okay, we got the engineering kinks worked out, we could mass produce it. It was not just affordable, but it was beautiful, all right? The cars were something we all wanted. And the fueling system was consumer friendly, all right? And we had a feedstock that was cheap and sustainable, all right? And in fact, hydrogen had been so successful and it was so pervasive that anywhere in the world that you went to buy a new car, you could only buy a hydrogen fuel cell car, all right? So we're there, right? You could the best you could hope for to roll out a new fleet is 10 to 15 years. That's you know, the best, because you simply cannot replace a fleet any faster than that economically. And that's an absurdly best-case scenario, because none of those things I mentioned, none of those conditions exists. So more realistically, we're looking at, you know, 20 to 30 years for a rollout. And keep in mind what happens to oil consumption during that period of time. Let's use 30 years. Picture, and this is the one time I wish I had a PowerPoint, but you know, we start here at about 83 million barrels of consumption every day, right? And then as we roll out this new fleet, that the curve begins to flatten out, and finally it levels off. And then it begins to decline. This is all good news, right? And then over the course of 30 years, we're using less and less and less oil. Until we reach the point 30 years where the gasoline combustion engine is gone. And we now have this brand new fleet in place. And there's still a residual consumption, obviously, where oil still has to be used. But the point is, we've drastically reduced our consumption, and that's great. But keep in mind the area under the curve. All the oil we had to burn simply to get there. We call this transition fuel, all right? You know, it's a declining amount every year, but it's nonetheless a massive amount of oil we will still need simply to fuel our transition away from oil. My point being that even if, you know, Al Gore were elected president of the world tomorrow, could happen. You're going to translate the movie, the Gore movie, you know, so. And began an aggressive and sense, you know, and smart move away from oil in the transportation sector. Even if that happened, we would still depend heavily on oil during that transition. Best case scenario. Which means that anything that interrupts or disrupts that supply, whether it's political that we've been talking about or some discovery that we don't have as much oil as we thought, anything that disrupts that curve, or let's say the technologies that we're counting on aren't as feasible as we'd hoped, anything that disrupts those assumptions puts us at grave peril. And that's sort of the best case. And you know, at this point in the conversation, it's good to remind yourself of something like Saudi Arabia. I mean, they have been saying they had 264 billion barrels of oil since the 1980s. All right, it hasn't changed. So, you know, how does that work? You know, there is concern among people both inside and outside the Saudi oil system that even they don't know how much oil they've got. All right, so as we begin, you know, as we both move through this conference and we begin picking apart some of the new technologies and the ideas behind them, and further, as you go out into the world to take these ideas with you and to begin sort of propagating them, keep in mind two things. First of all, there is no time to wait. There is simply no time to wait. The time is ripe. It's right now. Because, you know, already with the trajectory we've laid out, you know, assumes a whole bunch of things happening in our favor that may not be safe assumptions. But one thing we can know with absolute certainty is there's simply no longer time. You know, the time is now, right? Now, having depressed you as thoroughly as I possibly could, I want to leave you with a couple of more encouraging notes. And the first is, there are lots and lots of good things happening out there in the energy world. You know, hybrid technology, I mean, it's not where we want to be ultimately, but it's a fantastic sort of time-buying technology. It's an off-the-shelf technology. We don't have to wait for the fuel cell to show up. The hybrids are here. They're cutting emissions and consumption in half right away. Again, they're buying us time. They're teaching us about a new kind of car. They're teaching us that transportation technology can be modular. You don't have to have an internal combustion engine driving the wheels in it anymore. You don't have to do that. You can have, think of the hybrid as an electric car, essentially, that has electric motors, and those motors don't care where they get their juice, which really opens the door in terms of our thinking and our consumer acceptance to electric cars. And we're seeing a resurgence in electric cars, which is fantastic. That's great. Now, you know, consumers still have some concerns. They're worried about the sound of these cars. They're quiet. There's not that deep, throaty roar. But you can do that digitally. I mean, you can download whatever sound you want. You can make them sound like Howard Dean if you want to. I mean, so you seriously. But that's encouraging. I think another encouraging thing is biofuels. I mean, we all know that ethanol is not going to fuel the rest of the 21st century. But technologies that spring up around that are going to be critical. Critical part of the energy economy going forward. You know, and 5 years ago, we weren't even having that debate. You know, 5 years ago, ethanol was stuck in the margins, and that's it. And now it's become a huge part of the discussion. So it's a luxury to be having that debate. And I think the last encouraging bit is simply that you're all here. I mean, this is the theme of this conference is energy, and around the country and the world, conferences, professional conferences, scientific conferences, engineering conferences, students are coming together around these themes, and they're spending time listening and they're thinking about it. And that is absolutely critical, because it means that a critical mass, at least intellectually, has been reached. You know, people now consider energy to be as important as, say, well, almost as important as sex education. I mean, I always argue that it should be, we should be teaching it in schools with the same concern that we have about sex education, because, you know, really, what's the point of teaching your children about how to reproduce if the world that they're going to be reproducing into, you know, is so bleak? Now, consider, you know, what would the Texas Textbook Commission have to say about how energy is discussed? I mean, they would get just as worked up. But the point is, that's absolutely where we need to be, you know, in terms of how we approach this from a societal standpoint. And you know, I guess I'll leave you with that we can't allow this to be a stopgap measure. We can't simply patch. The problem cannot be a patch. You know, the cliche thing about the Chinese word for crisis is the same word for opportunity. Well, there's a huge important truth in that. Because right now what we can do, we can come up with a patch solution. We can go mine tar sands up in Alberta and produce a cheap synthetic crude. We can turn coal into a liquid fuel. We can do all those things, but there are tremendous costs, particularly in terms of climate. And we'll have to sequester carbon, etc. Those things can be done. But the point is, if we go for a patchwork solution, if we simply address this solution long enough to get us reelected into office, for example, we'll be back here in 5 or 10 years. Right? This is an opportunity to reinvent the way we use energy, produce energy, and think about energy. And the reinvention begins in places like this. So I want to thank you very much for being so attentive. I want to wish you the best the rest of the conference, and thanks for coming.
Good afternoon. I'm very happy to talk about some technological solutions to climate protection that are profitable, business-led, in the spirit of Raymond Williams' remark that to be truly radical is to make hope possible, not despair convincing. So let me start with the riddle of why is climate protection like the Hubble Space Telescope? Well, they were both messed up by a sign error. Someone mixed up a plus and a minus sign. The political debate around climate protection is all about who will bear the costs, burdens, and sacrifices this is presumed to require. And yet there's a parallel universe of practitioners, all of whom make money on climate protection. If these two universes ever meet and we discover that climate protection is actually about profits, jobs, and competitive advantage, that will make the politics very much simpler and obviate the dilemma that Fran Severin just talked about. Now, whether or not one believes climate change is a problem, smart companies are racing to solve it in order to make money. For example, two of our biggest chip makers in the world have been cutting their carbon emissions 6% a year, with typically 2 or 3 year paybacks on retrofits. DuPont set an ambitious goal of, by 2010, cutting its energy use per dollar of product 6% every year, while shifting substantially to renewables. For both energy and feedstocks, and cutting their greenhouse gas emissions by 65% below the 1990 level. That sounds awfully hard. How are they doing? Well, by 2004, they were 72% below the 1990 level. They were producing 30% more product with 7% less energy, and they made $2 billion profit on the deal. By 2006, that was an 80% saving below 1990, and they'd made $3 billion profit on the deal because efficiency is cheaper than fuel. BP similarly met its goal for operational carbon reductions 8 years early, and they bashfully said no net cost, so I probed a little, and they eventually admitted they'd made $650 million profit by substituting efficiency for fuel. That's now $1.6 billion. Interface has cut its greenhouse gas emissions in absolute terms by over half, two-thirds of it through energy efficiency, very lucratively, and that's a rate of GHG reduction of nearly 8% a year. TI, Texas Instruments, is just commissioning a new chip fab we helped design that is built in Texas, not China, because we cut $220 million out of the capital cost while saving a fifth of the energy and a third of the water. The next one will probably save over half the energy and cost even less to build. So while the politicians continue to lament and debate costs, the smart companies are racing to get to the profits before their competitors do. Now, we don't actually need a great deal of this activity to have a big effect. Economic theorists normally assume that the energy intensity of the economy, how much primary energy we use per dollar of GDP, will continue to drop by about 1% a year worldwide. But if that were 2% a year, CO2 emissions would level off. And if it were roughly 3% a year, it would drop fast enough to stabilize the Earth's climate, near as we can guess. Is 3% a year actually feasible? Well, in this country, we've been doing it in many periods of both high and low energy price without even paying attention. And California has done consistently about one percentage point faster than that. So our new houses here are four times more efficient than they were 30 years ago, and we're still saving a great deal more. China has done, for over 20 years, over 5% a year reduction in energy intensity from, of course, a very inefficient base. And for 4 years, they did nearly 8% a year. Then they came off the rails with the new construction boom, but probably this year they'll get back on track. They are the only country for which the top priority in development strategy is energy efficiency. And attentive companies, some of whom I've just listed, routinely save 6 or 8% a year. So what's so hard about 3? And since everybody up here made money doing efficiency instead of burning fuel, why should 3% a year even cost anything instead of profiting us? Now, it turns out that in this country, over half of our oil and gas and over three-quarters of our electricity can be saved at below the short-run marginal cost of producing it and delivering it from existing capacity. Even Japan, which in aggregates looks like the most energy-efficient country, can profitably save about two-thirds of its energy, according to a very good engineer who's president of Tokyo University. I think he's right. So noting that two-fifths of the CO2 emissions from fossil fuel come from burning oil and another two-fifths from running power plants with almost no overlap between the two, let me talk in turn about those two. And the other bits are directly used coal and gas that follow very similar principles. In September 2004, my team published an independent, detailed, peer-reviewed, transparent, and so far unargued-with roadmap called Winning the Oil Endgame, co-sponsored by the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Chief of Naval Research, and written for business and military leaders around competitive strategy for cars, trucks, planes, oil, and military. You can get the whole thing and its 24 technical annexes free at oilendgame.com. And its thesis is that by the 2040s, the U.S. can have eliminated its use of oil altogether and revitalized its economy, led by business for profit. So the transition could look like this. The official projections show oil use and oil imports rising towards the northeast corner, these red lines. But we showed how to turn those curves down along the green lines by redoubling the efficiency of using oil. We've already doubled it since 75, but we can double it again at an average cost of $12 a barrel in year $2,000. And we can then turn down even more steeply along the blue lines by replacing the other half of the oil with a combination of saved natural gas and advanced biofuel, mainly cellulosic ethanol, at an average cost of $18 a barrel. So the average of 12 and 18 is 15 bucks a barrel. That's what it costs not to use the oil, but do the same things, the same or better. And the difference between 15 and whatever oil price is potential profit, assuming that externalities are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. Now, we know this sort of thing can be done because we did it before. Notice how steeply oil use and imports dropped the last time we paid attention, from 1977 to 85. In those 8 years, GDP grew 27%, oil use fell 17%, oil imports fell by half, imports from the Persian Gulf fell by 87%, and they would have been gone in one more year if we'd kept that up. In fact, oil use and oil imports fell so much, OPEC's exports dropped by half, and it broke their pricing power for a decade because we customers, especially in America, the Saudi Arabia of mega barrels, had more market power than the oil supply cartel. Our power was on the demand side. We could save oil faster than they could conveniently sell less oil. That was practice. This is real. You are here. But we could run that play all over again much better with today's much more powerful technologies. Well, suppose that over the next 18 years, we invested $180 billion once. That's about what we spend on oil every half year. And we invested half of it in retooling the car, truck, and plane industries, and half of it in building a modern biofuels industry. And suppose that the oil we thereby didn't buy were priced at 26 bucks a barrel, the official forecast of 3 years ago, which might actually be about right if we did what I'm describing. In which case, that $180 billion investment would be saving $155 billion a year gross, $70 billion a year net, a very handsome return. The American CO2 emissions as a free byproduct would drop by 26%. We'd get 1 million new jobs, three quarters of them in rural and small town America. That's the biofuels part. And we would get to save 1 million jobs now at risk, mainly in automaking, where we have a really simple choice. Do we continue importing efficient cars to displace oil, or do we make efficient cars and import neither the oil nor the cars? We found in an American context, this could actually all be done without new fuel taxes, subsidies, mandates, federal laws, or anything else that either party doesn't like or could mess up. Because we're not relying here on public policy to force people to commit unnatural acts in the marketplace, but rather on a very compelling competitive strategy case for the businesses concerned to take us on this journey beyond oil for their own reasons. And as I'll describe, that is actually underway. Now, the core of it technologically is transport, which uses 70% of the oil. The other 30% goes to buildings and industry where there are big, cheap savings, often with lower capital cost. But we looked with particular care at cars, trucks, and planes and found that they could become three times as efficient as the official forecast for 2025 with all the same attributes, only safer. With respect to paybacks of 2 years, 1 year, and 4 or 5 years at U.S. fuel prices. And the trick is to make them ultra-lightweight, ultra-low drag, and use advanced propulsion systems like hybrids. By the way, all these technologies continue to improve much faster than we use them up, and much faster than the stunning advances already mentioned by Paul in finding and lifting oil. And therefore, efficiency is an ever bigger, cheaper resource to an extent that even many specialists fail to appreciate. Also, you often get better performance. For example, here's a two-seat carbon diesel hybrid Eco Sportster from Opel. It does 150 miles an hour and 94 miles a gallon, although not at the same instant. And one of the surprises for many is that the ultralighting that makes these carbon fiber concept cars twice as efficient does not actually increase production cost using new manufacturing methods because the cost of their materials are paid for by simpler automaking and a smaller propulsion system. So saving 69% of the fuel in cars and light trucks, for example, is like buying gasoline for 57 cents a gallon. Now, to see how to do this, we just have to ask where your gasoline goes. Your car uses every day about 100 times its weight in ancient plants, but 7/8 of that fuel energy never gets to the wheels. It's lost first in the engine, idling, driveline, and accessories. Of the 1/8 that does make it to the wheels, half of that either heats the tires and road or heats the air that the car is pushing aside, and only the last 6% actually accelerates the car and then heats the brakes when you stop. But since only 5% of the mass you're accelerating is you and the other 95% is the car, this means that only 5% of 6% or 0.3% of the fuel energy actually ends up moving the driver. This is not very gratifying after 120 years of devoted engineering effort. However, fortunately, 3/4 of the fuel use, both the acceleration term and the rolling resistance term, are caused by the car's weight. And every unit of fuel we can save at the wheels will save an additional 7 units we don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So there's enormous leverage in making the car radically lighter weight. Well, here's an uncompromised mid-sized suburban assault vehicle that we designed 7 years ago with a couple of European Tier 1s that illustrates this principle. It would be made out of carbon fiber composites weighing altogether less than half as much as an equivalent steel car, but safer even if they hit each other. Quite brisk acceleration, and the original design used a fuel cell to do 114 miles a gallon. Later on, we did a variant with a gasoline hybrid like a Prius at 67 miles a gallon. That's about 3.5 times more efficient than the steel equivalent, but at only $2,500 higher retail price, which we ascertained by actual bids at about a 500 line item level of detail from the supply chain. And that would be a 9-month payback at European or 22-month payback at U.S. fuel prices. And part of the attraction of this approach is the way it's made. You notice there are only 14 parts in the body. In fact, it looks kind of like an airframe. It's suspended from rings, not built up from a tub, which is our horse and buggy legacy of how we make cars. So it's very light, strong, and stiff. Now, these 14 parts can each be lifted with one hand and no hoist. In fact, the heaviest part, this side, I've lifted with one finger. And each part is made with one low-pressure die set. A steel body takes 10 or 20 times more parts, each with 4 steel stamping die sets. So that's about a 99% saving on tooling cost. Then these composite parts snap precisely together for gluing, kind of like a kid's toys, so you don't need jigs, robots, and welders to hold them in place and fit them together, therefore no body shop, and if you lay color in the mold, there's no paint shop, so there went the two hardest and costliest parts of making the car, and the total capital needed drops by at least 2/5 below the leanest plant in the industry. I actually brought a little sample along for what is now a properly shaped helmet that we're shipping from a little firm I chair in this field, just to show you that plastics have changed since the graduate. And this stuff is tougher than titanium and extraordinarily light. You may have seen a film in which Tom Friedman tries real hard to bash this with a sledgehammer, but it bounces off. And we can now make these aerospace-grade composites at automotive cost and speed. So think of this as like finding a Saudi Arabia under Detroit. It's even better than the one in the Gulf of Mexico, and it doesn't run out. It's over 8 million barrels a day. So basically, by making cars and light trucks out of this stuff, you lose half the weight and half the fuel. It gets safer because this absorbs 12 times the crash energy of steel per kilogram, and it costs the same to make the car. Now, on the supply side, I am not talking about corn ethanol, which is a rather small and costly and heavily subsidized resource, although it's improving, but rather cellulosic ethanol made of woody, weedy stuff like switchgrass and poplar, crop waste, forestry waste, which gives you twice the yield with less investment and up to 8 times better net energy yield, with some left over to displace petrochemicals. And these technologies are coming on very nicely. Just to illustrate the maturation of the sector, Brazil has replaced 1/4 of its gasoline energy already with sugarcane ethanol, competitive without subsidy. They got their initial startup subsidy back over 50 times over from the oil savings. Sweden has a good policy that I hope the new government will keep to get off oil by 2020 through cellulosic ethanol, mainly from the forest sector. Europe is a much bigger producer than we are of biodiesel as part of a strategy to shift farmers from subsidy to durable revenue, and over half that product is actually sold by oil companies. Here's how the moving parts fit together in the U.S. Instead of needing 28 million barrels a day of petroleum products in 2025, we could displace almost 7 of that with efficiency costing an average of $12 a barrel by then and still be in the process of saving another 7 as we complete the slow turnover of the vehicle fleets. We would get almost 6 from biofuels and the like, almost 2 from no-brainer substitutions of saved natural gas. We can save half our gas at about 1/8 the recent price, very straightforwardly. and then we would get almost 8 of forecast domestic production from areas already allowed, and still need 5 from someplace else. Where could we get that? Well, maybe we should buy more efficiency, it's so cheap, or wait a little longer and get the rest of it that we're still working on at that point. Or we could, of course, continue to buy oil from, say, Canada and Mexico, and by then the WTO will have made us drop our illegal 100% tariff on Brazilian ethanol, let that in, they'd love to sell it to us. Oh, but I haven't yet accounted for most of the saved natural gas. And it turns out that's enough, if directly substituted, to fill the rest of this oil balance. Or if even more profitably we were to make it into hydrogen, which you can use a lot more efficiently than oil or direct gas, then you could also displace the domestic oil this way. And I haven't counted other options. For example, just in the Dakotas, there's enough very windy available land to make, cost-effectively by then, enough wind power to make enough hydrogen, 50 megatons a year, to run every highway vehicle in the country at these levels of efficiency. Now, we're busy implementing this through a quiet little effort at our institute I'll let you in on. We call it institutional acupuncture. We figure out where the business logic is congested and not flowing properly. We stick needles in it to get it flowing. We need to flip the behavior of 6 sectors, and I'd say we're past the tipping point already on 3. One is aviation, where Boeing is beating Airbus with an efficiency leapfrog strategy based on advanced composites. Heavy trucks, where Walmart has already demanded from its suppliers doubled efficiency trucks. And we're broadening the buyer's consortium and speeding innovation in that sector. And then they'll go to tripled efficiency, which is a 60% internal rate of return. And military, which is just now emerging as the federal leader in getting the nation off oil, so they needn't fight over it. They can have nega missions in the Gulf, mission unnecessary. They really like that idea. We're coming along nicely in the fuel and finance sectors. The slow one, as expected, is light vehicles, but they're starting to change. You may notice that the new head of Ford Motor Company was the head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes. So he was leading that successful competitive leapfrog to a 1/5 more efficient, same cost, better airplane, half of which is advanced composites to make it ultra-light, and they're now rolling that out throughout their whole line of airplanes. So he's moved now to Ford with that cultural DNA, knowledge of how to do it, and transformational intent, strongly supported by the United Auto Workers and the dealers, who correctly feel that basic innovation is the only way to save this industry. So what's going on in automaking is what Schumpeter called creative destruction. And it's really opening minds. You know, gazing into the abyss does concentrate the mind wonderfully, not to mention potential leapfroggers and new market entrants. So the competition in this sector is at such a fundamental level that it's going to change the managers' minds or the managers, whichever comes first. Watch this space. Yesterday I was keynoting an automotive summit in L.A., and there's some very interesting conversations going on that you would not have heard a year ago. Now, you can go even beyond what I've described. I mean, just an excellent hybrid like a Prius, properly driven, not the way Consumer Reports says to drive it, will roughly double your efficiency. More with new diesels. And 11 days ago was tested the first digital engine, which looks about half again as efficient as a diesel burning any fuel on the fly and needing no cleanup to meet very stringent air quality standards. Other interesting advantages, including lower cost. Now, if you ultralight your hybrid and clean up some other details, you roughly redouble its efficiency. If you were to burn 85% ethanol in it, you would quadruple again your oil efficiency per kilometer, and you could put carbon back in the soil where it belongs and pay farmers for doing that. A good plug-in hybrid, and those are coming at us fast, could at least redouble fuel efficiency again, substituting a modest amount of electricity, and it could be attractive if you have smart ways to sell the distributed electric storage function to the grid when and where it's most valuable. That may pay for the expensive batteries. And so far, if you add all this up, or actually multiply it, you just saved 97% of the oil per kilometer. So yeah, you could do hydrogen as well, and there are smart ways to do it that are quite attractive if you start with efficient vehicles, but you don't really need to in order to save most of the oil. Now, let me turn to electricity, the other 2/5 of the CO2 problem. Back in the late 80s, we looked at the measured cost and performance data for about 1,000 electricity-saving technologies and concluded that if they were thoroughly retrofitted, where practical, they'd save about 3/4 of U.S. electricity at an average cost that in today's dollars would be about 1 cent a kilowatt hour. The utilities think tank found it was more like a 40 to 60% saving, not 75, at a somewhat higher cost, still below short-run marginal delivered price. But it turns out the difference between those two assessments was methodological rather than substantive. I don't care who's right. They're both very big numbers, and there have been similar, very detailed findings in rather efficient European countries. And the savings, as EPRI will agree, keep getting bigger and cheaper faster than we're using them up. And efficiency can work quickly. 10 million people in Southern California in the early 80s were cutting the Edison 10-year ahead forecast of peak load by 8.5% every year at about 1% the cost of making more electricity. In 1990, the big utility group in New England was had signed up 90% of a small business retrofit pilot program in just 2 months. Meanwhile, in the San Francisco area, PG&E signed up 1/4 of new commercial buildings for design improvements in 3 months. And then they said, oh, that's too easy. Let's raise the bar. So they did, and they got all of the bigger target next year in the first 9 days of January. So we really got pretty good at marketing this stuff. And we have lately had about 6 years of consistent reduction in electric intensity for the first time in this country. We have even better delivery methods now, as well as technologies. Now we don't just market megawatts, but we can make markets in megawatts, so we get the most competition in who saves and how to keep driving the savings and quality up and the cost down. But I want to go a lot further in suggesting what's important is not just great technologies, but new ways to combine them. So if you were to come visit my house at 7,100 feet in the Rockies, where you can get frost any day of the year, it can go to minus 47F, you can get 39 days of continuous midwinter cloud, you'd come into this central atrium, and it looks like this a year ago, and you'd find we've harvested 28 banana crops with no heating system. Why not? Well, I didn't need one, and it was cheaper up front not to put it in, and with the saved money plus another $16 a square meter, I saved also 99% of the water heating energy and 90% of the household electricity and half the water, all with a 10-month payback with 1983 technology. Now we can do a lot better. Here's a typical tract house near Davis and at 113 or 115F in Stanford Ranch in a PG&E experiment in the 90s. We showed that you could actually save about 4/5 of the normal California energy allowed at that time for such a house and make it cheaper to build. Or in Bangkok, a really difficult climate, here's a nice modern house built at exactly normal cost using 1/10 the normal air conditioning energy to provide superior comfort. So here we span the range of the Earth's climates, and the basic story is the same. We optimize the house as a system, not the windows or insulation or whatever as a component. And we optimize for multiple benefits. Now, in economic theory, we keep hearing of diminishing returns, that the more energy you save, the more and more steeply the cost of the next unit of savings goes up until it gets too expensive and you have to stop. But in those houses and many other cases, sure, at first I see diminishing returns as I add insulation to my house. That's how insulation works. But when I put in enough insulation, I don't need the heating system anymore. Guess what? I saved the whole capital cost of the furnace, fans, ducts, pipes, pumps, wires, controls, fuel supply arrangements, because I don't need them anymore. And that saved me more capital than I invested to get rid of them. So I end up saving 99% of the space heating energy, and the house costs less to build by about $1,100 in those days. Well, why should we get there the long way around when we can tunnel through the cost barrier to that destination? Or consider a pumping example. Pumps are the biggest user of electricity for motors, and motors use 3/5 of all the electricity in the world. Well, we had a case where the top, I believe, German firm had, in a certain industry, had optimized a runaround loop for heat transfer to use 70.8 kilowatts A Dutch colleague redesigned it to use 5.3 kilowatts, which is 92% less. It cost less to build. It worked better in every way just by using fat, short, straight pipes rather than skinny, long, crooked pipes. This is not rocket science. This is good Victorian engineering rediscovered. And then we found that we'd left a factor 4 on the table. We should have saved about 98% by counting 7 more benefits. You start to see how you can save a lot of electricity this way. And it's particularly nice when you go all the way downstream. I mean, you can feed about, say, 10 units of coal into a classical power plant, lose 2/3 of it there, lose more in the wires, more in all the conversion, in order to get 1 unit, 1/10 as much, of flow out of the pipe. So turn those compounding losses around backwards. It's just like the car example. You save another 10 units of coal you don't need to waste getting it to the pipe, so to speak. In other words, every unit of flow or friction you save in the pipe will save 10 units of coal and pollution and global weirding back at the power plant. Huge leverage. And also, as you go back upstream, the equipment gets smaller, simpler, and cheaper, so your capital cost goes down. So that's why you always start savings downstream, which is not the way most designers do it. It's not that difficult. For example, often you go into a factory or a big building, and you find a big pump that's supposed to send something up a pipe. And next to it is an identical in-place spare because it's a very important pump. And they draw it like this and they build it like this. So all the time the flow has to go through 2 right angle bends and typically 2 valves. Why don't we do it this way with no bends and no valves or 1 valve? Well, just because we haven't done it that way before. But a great engineer over in Oakland, Peter Rumsey, did that as a retrofit in the Oakland Museum. And he ended up, in this case, saving 3/4 of the pumping energy with these Y bends, sweet bends. You notice this pipe's running diagonally through the air. To do that, you tell the plumbers and pipe fitters to lay out the supply pipes as if they were drains, right? Because they got another part of their brain that knows that if drains have bends, they clog. And in this case, he also eliminated altogether 15 pumps that will never again waste energy and maintenance. Nega pumps are a really good kind. Now, in our practice, in private industry, we have lately redesigned about $30 billion worth of stuff. And, you know, whether it's chip fabs, oil refineries, North Sea oil platform, a $5 billion gas to liquids plant, world's second biggest LNG plant, the world's biggest platinum mine, data centers, supermarkets, chemical plants, a Navy cruiser, a luxury yacht, you name it. Typically, in retrofits, we'll end up saving 30 to 60% of the energy with a 2 or 3 year payback. In new installations, we save about 40 to 90%, and the capital cost almost always goes down, not up. So this, of course, takes some reforms in engineering practice and pedagogy. Go to 10xe.org to read about our plot. I hope you will join for the nonviolent overthrow of bad engineering, because I'm sick and tired of retrofitting stuff that wasn't designed right. Obviously, if it were designed right, we couldn't do any of this. But we have now demonstrated tunneling through the cost barrier in 29 sectors, so we think it's real and generalizable, and we understand pretty well how to do it. And actually, it works also at a macro level, even without those innovations in design, just by better appliance and building efficiency standards and rewarding utilities for cutting your bills, not selling you more energy. California has held per capita use of electricity flat for 30 years while it kept going up in the rest of the country, and that has saved this state about $100 billion on power systems investment that could be, of course, and was, more productively spent elsewhere. Now, I want to just comment briefly on a shock that's happened on the supply side of the electricity system. These are 2 graphs of actual data on the left of the vertical line and industry projections on the right for micropower. The tan part, the larger part, is cogeneration or combined heat and power, 2/3 gas-fired. So it saves at least half the carbon compared to what it replaces. And the upper graph here is electricity produced in the world by micropower. The lower graph is capacity installed. Now, the colored wedges underneath the cogen are distributed renewables, which were about a $38 billion market in 2005. That's all the renewables except big hydro. And in 2005, it turns out that these low-carbon or no-carbon sources of electricity, which we were just told won't be competitive for quite a while, actually added 4 times as much output and 11 times as much capacity as, say, nuclear added. And they produced 1/6 of the world's electricity and 1/3 of the world's new electricity. In fact, in 13 industrial countries, they provided from a sixth to over half of all electricity. And this doesn't count electric savings, which were probably about as big, and they're even cheaper. So why is micropower winning? Why have micropower and negawatts together captured upwards of half the world market in electrical services while central thermal plants have less than half? Well, simple. This stuff is cheaper and has lower financial risk. That's why it's financed by private risk capital. There isn't a nuclear project on Earth that's financed by private risk capital. They're bought by central planners. This ought to tell us something. So to test this hypothesis that maybe micropower is getting bought like mad because it's cheaper, I updated the best U.S. empirical data on what it costs to make and deliver a kilowatt hour, or to save it, from either remote resources, which require a delivery cost to get to your meter, and I picked a low one, or on-site resources that are already delivered. Your actual costs may vary, but I've done the comparison in a way that is favorable to central plants. And for those, I use the canonical MIT study of 2003, baking in the subsidies that the plants got in those days, and not counting the big reserve margin that they require. So a nuclear plant and then the delivery cost gets you to close to 10 cents a kilowatt hour delivered. Now the capital cost has gone up by already a fifth, so add another cent. And if you had really big subsidies, it might come down here. Well, we do have really big subsidies for the next six units in this country, roughly equal to their entire capital cost, whereupon Standard & Poor's put out a couple of reports saying this would not materially improve the builders' credit ratings because the market is still concerned about the remaining risks. So I think even that enormous distortion will have roughly the same effect as defibrillating a corpse. It will jump, but it won't revive. But if it did work, then you'd get down to roughly where a coal plant was, but then if you put $100 a ton carbon tax on a coal plant, it would get up here, and similarly for a combined cycle gas plant. So the policymakers in Washington keep juggling the subsidies and taxes to try to get the answer they want, not noticing, however, that central thermal plants are all uneconomic. Look at what we could buy instead. For example, suppose you assume that wind power costs over twice as much as the cheapest plants have cost installed through 2005, but only the median going back to 99. And of course, costs have been falling rapidly during that period. And let's also firm the wind so it's fully dispatchable. You can have it whether the wind's blowing or not. So it's entirely comparable to the central thermal plants. Now, if you took away its production tax credit, it would be up here, but meanwhile, it keeps getting cheaper. And there are a lot of other renewables that are clearly doing very well in the market as well. Combined heat and power, garden variety, or in buildings, making cooling as well, or with recovered waste heat is typically even cheaper. Cheapest of all, end-use efficiency in commercial and industrial retrofits, or a bit more with residential, a bit less if you're really good at it. You get the idea. You can see why the stuff to the right of my cursor is what the market is mainly buying to meet new electrical service needs in the world, while the stuff to the left, the central thermal plants, are not doing so well. And this has an important implication for climate protection. I can spend about 10 cents to make and buy a new nuclear kilowatt hour, and that will displace 1 kilowatt hour of coal power. Sounds good. Trouble is, if I spent the same 10 cents buying cheaper stuff, I get more of it. That's what cheaper means. So I would actually displace 2 to 10 kilowatt hours of coal-fired generation with the same money. And if I don't do that, I'm making things worse. In other words, if climate's a problem, we need the most solution per dollar and the most solution per year. And that means investing judiciously, least cost, best buys first, and not indiscriminately. Now, there's always a risk that when you try to buy something, it won't work, you get a dry hole. But we had an experiment in California, 82 to 85, in which we had pretty level playing field between ways to make and save electricity. And the result was that just in those 4 years, the utilities bought or were firmly offered 143% of their peak load in savings or alternative supply, mostly renewable, and they had to cut off the bidding because otherwise in another year they would have had to shut down every fossil and nuclear plant in the state, which, you know, in hindsight might not have been such a bad idea. And these resources are also huge, whether it's efficiency or cogen or wind, which in this country has over twice the potential we need to meet all our electric needs, same in China, 6 times in the UK, 9 times worldwide, other renewables even bigger. And the variability that Severin referred to is actually not a significant issue if properly integrated into the grid. And the reason is we've already bought more backup than we need for that. in order to cope with the intermittence of the big thermal stations. So I think the collapse of nuclear power in the market is a very good thing for climate protection, because you can get more protection per dollar and per year and huge macroeconomic leverage in funding other needs instead. And you also inhibit the spread of nuclear bombs by taking away the innocent-looking civilian disguise and the ingredients of do-it-yourself bomb kits. The way to get there is to take markets seriously, not literally, and let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly, no matter which kind they are, what they are, where they are, how big they are, or who owns them. This is pretty much the opposite of present energy policy, but I think such a market-based energy policy would make the oil and climate and proliferation problems go away, and we'd have a richer, fairer, more democratic, cooler, and safer world. So I'm grateful for your kind attention. We are, of course, the people we've been waiting for. Just remember Marshall McLuhan's remark, if this seems too good to be true. He said, only puny secrets need protection. Great discoveries are protected by public incredulity. But it's your move. Thank you.
I think this is a question for Paul. I was told once, speaking of oil, shale, and sand, that there's not enough natural gas in all of North America to convert to hydrogen to refine said oil sand, the oil from those sands, and therefore it's a dream which cannot really be fulfilled.
So. Well, I mean, the question is, you know, do we have enough natural gas to kind of do all the things that we want to do with it? And yeah, natural gas is promising on a number of reasons. It's certainly cleaner than coal or oil. It's a great feedstock, or at least a kind of a first stage feedstock for hydrogen. The issue with natural gas is similar to that, the one we face with oil, which is that we have domestically a somewhat constrained supply. We could be doing more to be producing domestically, but keep in mind if we're wanting to kind of use natural gas as a bridge fuel, as I advocate, to kind of get us from where we are now to where we want to be, we're going to have to come up with some substantial new supplies. Now, Amory has made some important points about what we could be doing in terms of making our consumption of it more efficient. But supply will have to increase, and the two kind of primary ways of increasing it, whether you're trying to use it to refine shale oil or whatever, are through imports, big pipeline from the north, or LNG shipping. Both are expensive, both are politically challenging, and LNG in particular, I mean, you're living in kind of ground zero of LNG proposals. You know, everyone here is in favor of clean natural gas, but no one wants to put up with the regasification facilities to bring it in. And I think this really raises an important point about the energy economy of the future. You know, many of us have the luxury of not having to look at our energy infrastructure. We might bitch and moan about some overhead transmission lines, but for the most part, the dirty work can be done elsewhere. It'd be done either in, you know, Virginia in a coal mine or in Saudi Arabia, and we can enjoy the benefits of the energy. And it may be that the energy economy of the future, we have to look at it. It may be, you know, our roofs now look differently. You know, our cars certainly will look differently. But energy consumption and production will have to begin to look much more visible, and we'll have to be much more conscious of it. So I think natural gas is probably one of the first places that sort of new reality is going to dawn.
Let me draw a little distinction. With the new Shell process for shale oil, you wouldn't actually need to put in hydrogen to refine the stuff, because it is, in effect, refined in situ. And the big question is whether the in situ heating of the rock to drive off essentially refined products is done with electricity or gas, and there's still experiments going on to figure that out. I think the process will still be grossly uneconomic compared to what I described, but it's a reasonable thing to have in Shell's portfolio to try it out as an experiment on the scale they're doing, which is very small, and see what the numbers are. In the case of tar sands, natural gas is a big deal, although I think they actually run out of water first. Maybe Michael Moore will tell us later which gets you first. I don't think the LNG folks will actually make money. They need about 3.5 or offshore $4 gas. But for less than a dollar per MCF or gigajoule, we can save half the gas in the country, and I think that's a very conservative number. The biggest part of that saving, roughly 8 of the 12 TCF a year we can save, is actually from saving electricity, particularly on peak, which we make very inefficiently in simple cycle combustion turbines burning gas. They're so inefficient that if you save 1% of the kilowatt hours in the country, including the peak hours, you thereby save 2% of all the gas in the country and cut its price 3 or 4%. So gigantic leverage there. And somebody here, I think, from Dow, thanks to Dow for first pointing out that huge elasticity of substitution. And it's very much in the interest of the petrochemical companies that want affordable gas so they can stay on shore to promote that kind of saving, which means in 48 states we ought to start rewarding utilities for cutting your electric bill, not for selling you more electricity. By the way, we have done that decoupling and shared savings for natural gas in 8 or 10 states, and outfits like NRDC and Energy Foundation are spreading it gradually to the rest of the country.
Thank you. Do we have any questions over on this side? I know.
Yep. Right here.
Please stand.
I have a question for each of you. Mr. Roberts first. I'm fairly ignorant in this area, but I was wondering, you emphasized the gasoline consumption, but as far as the oil production, is the oil production, the daily rate that you give, you cited, is that for production of gasoline? Because oil is used in a number of other products, and I was wondering what percentage is used in other products out of that daily yield, and what is actually devoted to gasoline production?
That's a great question. I mean, more than half of the oil that's produced worldwide goes into transportation fuels. So when we're talking about, and then, you know, it's roughly, I believe it's roughly half between diesel and gasoline. Then there's, you know, smaller gradients of air, you know, jet fuel, and we have, you know, the kind of industrial lubricants. So when we're thinking about what oil, what it would cost to our economy to lose oil, for example, obviously the biggest hit is in the transportation sector, and that's where it's been the hardest to replace. I mean, we used to burn oil to make power, you know, to make electricity in this country, and now that became so expensive that we moved to things like coal and nuclear power, natural gas. But it was easy to substitute, whereas we've struggled, you know, for a century really to find some substitute for oil in the transportation sector. But when people talk about the oil problem, they're really focused on transportation, because in almost all other sectors it's replaceable. And transportation is where it's been the hardest.
There are shifts in the product slate in the future I outlined, and you'll find them in our book. The big surprise to a lot of people is that companies, or typically countries, because they own 94% of the reserves, that own oil in the ground will actually make more money in a world that buys no oil. And the reason is that the hydrogen in a hydrocarbon is typically worth more without the carbon than with the carbon, even if nobody pays you to keep carbon out of the air. The reason is you can use hydrogen two or three times more efficiently in a good fuel cell than you can use hydrocarbons in a good conventional engine. And therefore, you'll make more money ultimately taking hydrogen out of your hydrocarbons with a reformer than putting more hydrogen into them in a refinery. In this sense, the highest and best use of coal will be to pull hydrogen out of steam in a way that's carbon sequestered. And three of the world's top five coal producers now understand this and are revaluing their coal assets through the lens of the hydrogen value chain.
Second question for you. You mentioned wind energy, and I don't have the facts on this, but I heard somewhere in the past that when you have a wind farm, that changes the local weather patterns and causes peripheral problems because of those farms.
No.
No. And do you know anything currently? Is there any interest in coal gasification as an alternative?
I'm sorry, do I, about what?
About coal gasification as an alternative energy concept at this point. It was during the Carter administration.
Yeah, like coal liquefaction, it's made largely of capital and water. The coal part is a lot less important. Gas to liquids, especially in places with stranded gas like Qatar, make more sense. And I've actually helped redesign such a plant recently for major capital and energy savings. But even with that redesign, it is still grossly uneconomic compared to the efficiency and some biofuel options that I outlined. So you have to remember that we're dealing here with fungible commodities in a competitive global market. There's all manner of technologies you can use for supply. We're going to hear a lot about them in the next couple of days. But you really have to do rigorous economics to figure out which ones will be able to compete, and most of them will not. I think in my quick introduction to efficiency, I gave you some idea where the best buys are, and they're almost all on the demand side, and they're huge. They're enough that most of that supply just won't make it unless the taxpayers decide to buy it as a present for the industries.
We have two more questions. We get the microphone.
Yeah, great.
Thank you. My question is for Amory Lovins. First of all, it was a privilege to hear your talk. And the contrast between Professor Borenstein's presentation and your presentation could not have been greater. I think Professor Borenstein painted a rather grim picture that things are not likely to change, and we're likely to go much higher to levels of maybe 500, 600 ppm CO2. Your picture was a very optimistic one, and in listening to the two, I kept trying to understand what the difference was. It seemed that you believe the changes you're advocating can happen without actually requiring, for example, a tax on carbon or incentives to change behavior, and that's basically my question. Is that so?
Well, the difference, I think, underneath is that he's an excellent economist. I'm a recovering physicist. And these are two quite different worldviews that have different ideas of what's a fact and what's a hypothesis. For an economist, fact is observed historic price elasticities. To me, those are interesting, and they tell you something about behavior. But under conditions that no longer exist and that it's your job to change as much as possible, so it's kind of like driving while looking in the rearview mirror. Economics has some very valuable tools, but as a kind of hands-on practitioner, I actually treat measured cost and performance of technologies as empirical, and I do pay a lot of attention to the market failures that really dominate behavior in the energy marketplace. If you go to rmi.org, then library, then climate, you'll find a 1997 publication called Climate Making Sense and Making Money that lists 60 or 80 market failures in buying energy efficiency and the business opportunity each one can be turned into. And I think Severin and I would agree that Prospector's Guide is really important to understand, because barrier busting is really the top policy priority. It's important to get prices right. I'll never disagree with the value of correct pricing. I think higher energy prices through, say, carbon taxes or trading are helpful, but not necessary and not sufficient for very productive use of energy. They're not necessary because, as you saw empirically, we can get excellent returns at the old low prices with nobody paying for putting carbon in the air. And higher energy prices are not sufficient because if you don't bust the barriers to responding to the prices you see, not much will happen. That's why DuPont long paid twice the energy price in Europe as in the U.S., and yet its chemical plants were no more efficient in Europe than in the U.S. Of course, they were designed by the same people in the same way using the same processes and equipment, so they had essentially the same efficiency. There isn't much room for behavioral change in a chemical plant. So prices matter. Ability to respond to price matters even more and deserves a lot more of our attention than most economic theorists give it. Severin is unusual in this regard in that he understands the reality of market failure, and I think we have a very broad agreement on the importance of fixing it and turning it into a business opportunity.
I need to just throw something out, and that is that the space between these two visions, if you will, leaves a lot of room for a discussion of maybe a political commodity. I mean, we talk about oil as a political commodity because we're clearly not comfortable allowing the market to determine the price. We'll do all sorts of things. We'll invest heavily in, say, the Fifth Fleet and send it over to the Middle East to make sure that that oil flows freely. And these costs, we don't really know how to talk about these costs, but they're external, clearly. I think we have to keep in mind that markets that are allowed to respond the way that Amory's describing could do some amazing things, and we hope they will. But we also must keep in mind that there are certain sort of somewhat intangible forces out there. There's a political weight to an asset that's been invested in. You know, a coal company that makes massive investments in a mine a power plant. All these things are, you know, represent substantial investments, and there's no way that these companies are simply going to walk away if they feel that those investments are threatened. And they will bend the political fabric in this country to ensure that their assets are protected. And they will disregard market forces as long as they can do it, as long as they have the political power to do it. And it's that, I mean, we can have a magnificent vision laid out where everything makes sense, but if all the players aren't playing along, very little will happen. So, for example, you can picture a scenario where you have to buy off the coal industry to get anything done in climate. Coal is one of the biggest obstacles to climate policy in this country. So it stands to reason you can say to the coal people, look, to get you out of the way, we'll pay to make sure that coal is part of the next energy economy. We'll pay to make clean coal a reality, okay? We'll subsidize it, simply so you will go along, get out of the way politically. Once that happens, then maybe we can have a cap and trade for carbon. Then we can move forward. And perhaps 20 years down the line, the market looks at coal and says, you know what? It doesn't make sense. Clean coal doesn't make sense. But we had to spend a lot of money and a lot of political capital to get that far. You know, I guess the picture I'm trying to paint here is that there's a difference between kind of a reality, a possibility, and a political reality. Avery does an excellent job of telling us what's possible, but it's really up to us as political units to kind of drive toward that.
I would just ask both of you and all of you to reflect, why is it that China, in its 11th five-year plan, made its top development priority energy efficiency and leapfrog technologies to achieve it? It wasn't because of Kyoto or any other international agreement. It's because the Chinese leadership, which is very smart, realized they can't afford to develop otherwise.
Let me give an opportunity to Severin to make a comment.
Actually, that's a good lead-in, because at the same time, China's also building last-generation coal plants extremely rapidly that will put out CO2 for decades to come. And I think the problem is, Amory paints a very exciting picture of a lot of technologies, and some of which are very economic, and it's hard for an economist to say this, but it's also behavioral. It's not just economics. It's getting it is well understood within the energy community that energy efficiency is a big winner, and there's a lot of opportunities out there at below the price of electricity, and yet they don't get taken up very quickly. I've seen Amory give talks like this for many years, and progress is being made, but I have to say that certainly if I had taken him at his word 10 years ago, I think we might have been disappointed of where we are today, and the uptake of these perfectly reasonable ideas is just frustratingly slow. That's why I guess in some ways I have been a big advocate for energy efficiency subsidies, even though I'm an economist, even though they are in the money, because they make sense. And I have actually been a big detractor of subsidies for photovoltaic cells because they're way out of the money. And I think if we're going to push a technology, we should be pushing one that makes real sense.
Thank you. We have one last question. Tony, can we get the microphone down?
It's more of a comment, really, and relates to what you were saying, Amory, because you've obviously excited everybody with this wonderful vision of what we can do if we can sort of reduce CO2 emissions. But I did want to challenge you on one specific issue, and it's the following. If we completely stop CO2 emissions tomorrow, not cut them by 3% a year for the next 20 years, but stop them completely tomorrow, the world is still going to continue to warm up for the foreseeable future, because there's more energy coming in,
sure,
reaching the surface of the Earth, and is going out. And that's not going to change until the CO2 levels in the atmosphere go down to the levels that they were kind of pre-industrial revolution.
Sure.
If I can just finish, you know, according to the United Nations Climate Panel, that's going to take, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And so I think what you're suggesting is fantastic, but I don't want people here to get the impression that we do all these things and we can forget about climate change. Mm-hmm. Climate change is going to be a major problem, even with all the things you suggest.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, of course there are lags. There's the big thermal lag in the ocean. But my point is, instead of going from 380 to 450 and points north, we could actually stabilize around 400, 410, and then come down rather quickly beyond that.
It's rather quickly, I'm challenged. Rather quickly is
No, and what you're pointing out correctly is that even if we do that, that the what we've already set in motion and the extra hump beyond that will still continue to have a long tail of consequences. It's just that we can make those enormously less, and there's at least reason to hope we could avoid some or all of the abrupt climate change scenarios that otherwise would become highly likely. So I think it's a matter of urgency to follow that kind of trajectory. And it is. And Severin's right. I mean, I've been laying out this thesis for 20 or 30 years, even in a book in 81 called Least Cost Energy, Solving the CO2 Problem, with all the graphs of how to do that. But, you know, Churchill said you can always count on Americans to do the right thing once they've exhausted all other alternatives. We're just working our way down the list.